This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In 1949, Bonnie Cohn founded what in the 1960s would become the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. Aside from academics, she had a dream for the school. She saw it as a spiritual sanctuary, a place for many students of many faiths to come together with a common goal. To that end, one of her first hires when the school became part of the UNC system was Dr. Loy Witherspoon, a religious studies professor. Now, a lot has changed at colleges and in society since the mid-20th century. Mainline religions have been steadily losing memberships, and attitudes about religion, particularly among the young, have radically changed. But a recent UCLA study of students in college reveals that though church attendance may be declining among students, they are becoming increasingly more liberal in their attitudes towards religion and more spiritual. Is the same true on campuses here? We're going to take a closer look at that this hour with one of Loy Witherspoon's successors, Dr. Joanne Robinson, Chair and Associate Professor of the Department of Religious Studies at UNC Charlotte. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Mike.
She's in our studio along with Dr. Barbara Tita, Rabbi at Temple Or Olam and Senior Lecturer teaching Jewish Studies in the Department of Religious Studies at UNC Charlotte. Welcome back.
Nice to be here.
And also we're joined by the Reverend Robert Spach, the Chaplain at Davidson College.
Great.
Good morning. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. We'll just all talk at the same time. We have to get our timing down here. A lot of colleges and universities, Davidson College among them, were founded by religious organizations or are controlled by or were controlled by offshoots of churches and other religious organizations. How unusual is it for a public college, Charlotte College, which would later become UNC Charlotte, to be started with a spiritual intent in mind, of some sort in mind?
That's a great question. As you probably know, our colonial colleges, nine of them, were primarily sponsored by religious organizations, with the exception of what became the University of Pennsylvania. When Bonnie Cohn came on the scene in the 1940s, she had a vision for UNCC that was in some ways in line with the land-grant universities that we see, 70 of which got established after about 1862 when the Morrill Land-Grant Act came in and state universities were sponsored. Those universities were specifically established as agricultural universities, but with the language that said that there should be liberal education as well. Mm-hmm. Bonnie Cohn believed very strongly in that dream. But she also was very, very, as you said, vocal about having this idea that it be a place where students can come and speak to people of other faiths and be, I guess, what students today would call spiritual together. So she had a vision about a meditation area on campus. Mm-hmm. That has never come to pass, but people on campus occasionally work toward that mm-hmm. ideal. So Bonnie Cohn, in a way, as an outlier in that she made it very public that she thought that was an important part of a university education. That said, there are many state universities on which religious life and spiritual life are very important for the students and the faculty as
well.
Now,
Davidson College was established in 1837 by the Presbyterian Church, and you have already established a meditation area on campus, I'm understanding. It's a maze. Is that what it is?
It's a labyrinth.
A labyrinth, right?
Which, unlike a maze, you can't get lost.
That's right. You can see where you're going. why was it decided to put that? Because that's a recent development. Why was that decided why did you decide to install that?
It really came out of the impetus of students, one particular student who was an art student and who had read about the importance of labyrinths in creativity. And she approached the dean of students, who then referred her to me. And we spoke about the opportunity of creating something that would be of use both in the academic area for students who might be artists, as well as in the whole realm of spiritual and religious mm-hmm. life, because, of course, labyrinths have been used for centuries in many different traditions. And so we found a great spot on campus to create it. It's sort of a park area, and students of all different backgrounds and traditions or no particular religious tradition can use it as a space for walking meditation.
There are sects of nuns and priests in the Catholic tradition who are contemplative, which is another word for meditation. They pray, they think, they dwell on God as part of their devotion, as part of their vocation. But these labyrinths and this idea that you can go and meditate is kind of an Eastern philosophy, isn't it? Doesn't it mostly come from Asia and places like that? The idea that meditation is something we should engage in every day?
It's actually an ancient part of the Christian tradition, going back to the Desert Fathers and Mothers, who really sought spaces that were very open and quiet to meditate. And it's part of Christianity in a variety of different traditions, both the Orthodox, the Eastern Orthodox traditions, as well as within Catholicism. Hmm. Not as much within Protestantism, I must say. It's becoming more so gradually now in the Protestant traditions.
So UNC Charlotte does not have a place for meditation yet, at the one that Bonnie – at least not like Bonnie Cohn.
Well, there are the botanical gardens.
Well, you could go there. You can meditate anywhere.
Yes, I mean, you can
at that level, yes.
But what about – you also have no place to worship. There are no churches. There are no synagogues. There is no Hillel house.
That's correct.
That is correct. There's no residential place for students, and there's no one center for worship.
There is a student group that is supported by some faculty members. I'm one of them. To agitate for the building of a permanent space that would be open to all traditions, that would be a way to provide students of any tradition a place for meditation and prayer. That has been part of Bonnie Cohn's dream, and there are students who are actively working towards that as we speak.
I was going to ask, is there a push on the part of students for something like this?
There is indeed. As I said, they have a website.
And would you say that push has increased measurably in the last, 5, 10, 15 years? Or is this something that's been going on since the beginning?
I would say it's been more on and off. Although recently the on has been certainly stronger than it was, say, 3 to 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. It depends, as these kinds of things often do, on individual students and their energy and the input that they have into that kind of project.
I know that you have a problem with the premise of the show we're doing today, which is just fine, because I often have a problem with the premise of the show.
Right. And,
but you're coming at it from a Jewish perspective. Explain this.
And an academic one.
Okay.
When we begin a program that starts with the state of faith on college campuses, then we're starting with Christian language. That language is Christian and Protestant, right? The word faith is a very important word in those denominational settings. It is not an important word in the Jewish setting, in many Jewish settings, let me say. And as I spoke to a colleague of mine in the Department of Religious Studies yesterday who teaches Eastern religions, he says, I never use the word faith. You know, Hinduism, faith, those two things don't match
up. But do you use the word spirituality? Do you use the word meditation or contemplation or dwelling?
Excellent question.
Putting your thoughts with God.
Right. So In terms of now, I'm going to be speaking as a rabbi, right, rather than as an academic. I would say that we certainly speak in Jewish traditions a great deal about deed, about what you do in the world, not necessarily what you believe, but what you do in the world. So Judaism tends in broad strokes to be around deed rather than creed. You don't get thrown out of synagogues for being skeptical or challenging about belief. And faith, you can walk into most synagogues in most denominational settings and be agnostic and be perfectly accepted as a Jewish practitioner, as someone who identifies as Jewish, whether you are religious or spiritual or not, you may still define yourself as Jewish in cultural terms.
Well, let me ask all three of you this question, since some of you may not agree with the premise of the program. Spirituality, what is it? I mean, how do you define spirituality versus religiosity?
That is a fantastic question, and it's one of the big questions that haunts these surveys that we look at that tell us that spirituality is on the rise and religiosity is on the wane among college students or whatever particular population we're polling. To begin with, people lie on surveys, particularly about sex and religion. And
it also depends on how the survey was taken. If you take
absolutely.
It in a group setting where people voice out loud,
yes.
they're going to lie. But if you do it on paper where they can do it in private and it's not – their name isn't attached to it, they're more likely to be truthful.
I would agree with that, but I would also say that when you're polling freshman students newly on a college campus about things like religion and spirituality, you are likely to get guarded answers. in part because they're freshmen and they feel that they need to be guarded and they're being watched.
Really?
This question of
Could it also be that they're still under the influence of how they were raised?
Exactly.
And they don't want to break
from that.
That's
what I mean in part by being watched by their parents, by the institution. There's this interesting dynamic that goes on where students are on the one hand suddenly experiencing a freedom that they've never had before and on the other hand still very much stuck in the ways that they have been taught to think. So college is a wonderful time to get them to think about these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. But back to this question of spirituality, when this one survey that we're looking at that was in the early 2000s and a more recent one that actually shows us that students are about split one-third secular, one-third religious, and one-third spiritual, and we can talk about how those definitions came about. Very often, the students are doing the defining themselves. And when I ask students in class what they mean when they say, I'm spiritual but not religious, which they say very often, they almost always say, it means I don't like an institutional religion or a traditional place that I have to go and do certain things. I instead am more interested in my personal connection to God, my personal spiritual quest, my desire to find meaning in life.
Robert Spock, you're a reverend. Do you hear these things? Because, I mean, you're the chaplain at Davidson.
Right.
It would seem to me that you are an insider in the world of religion and that students who may be feeling more spiritual as opposed to religious may not come to you and express these thoughts.
I think I get a range. I would say some students are deeply religious and also think of themselves as deeply spiritual. I've also had students who are trying to figure out what spiritual life means because they've grown up in families that have completely jettisoned that, or they've grown up in cultural contexts, whether in China or in the former Soviet Union, where religion was just not part of what they experienced. And they'll come to my office sometimes and they'll be like, there's something that other students here at Davidson talk about and think about, and I don't understand it at all, and I'd like to talk about it.
But Davidson started, as we've said, as a Presbyterian school, but you have, in the last several years, broadened the base not only of students but of faculty and staff and leaders on the campus to include all religions from all parts of the world and all faiths, even I guess including atheism, if you want to call that a faith. How has that changed things at Davidson? Are you still finding the same number of students who would be considering themselves religious as opposed to spiritual or even just secular?
Right. Well, the demographics at Davidson actually line up pretty well with the demographics nationally in terms of the number of students who identify as Catholic, the number of students who identify as Protestant, the number of students who identify with other world religions, and the number of students that say they're agnostic or atheist or humanist or simply spiritual but not religious, that kind of thing. Yeah. And that number, the last number, has definitely grown a lot over the past 20 years at Davidson, as it has throughout this country.
Does Davidson have a religious studies department?
Yes.
UNC Charlotte certainly does. We have two representatives from that department. Is it unusual for a public institution to have a religious studies department?
No, not at all.
Okay.
And in part, this is going back to that land grant idea that the colleges that were started as state institutions were explicitly to teach agriculture, practical arts, also military tactic, interestingly enough, but also to retain the classical studies. And one of the original classical liberal arts was theology. Mm. Now, I say that word, and again, you know, Barbara will probably say, well, here we are in Protestant land again. And absolutely we are. It's one of those things that religious studies departments have to deal with. So this idea that theology is one thing, religious studies is teaching about religion. It's not teaching people how to be a particular kind of religion.
We have to take a break. We'll come back with more of this discussion about the rising amount of spirituality versus religiosity on college campuses. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting an evening with Harry Connick Jr., multi-talented musician, singer, and American Idol judge. Performs live in Belk Theater February 17th, 2015. Tickets available at 704-372-1000. And Donald Hack Diamonds, celebrating with a holiday open house at their new location in Moorcroft Village in South Park tomorrow through Saturday. Details and holiday schedule at Donald Hack. CMPD.com. Well, CMPD has been using secret cell phone tracking devices to follow suspected criminals, but in the process, they pick up a lot of data from private citizens who aren't doing anything illegal. And this technology has been used locally and nationally. It was created to fight terrorism, and it's very effective in fighting crime, but it does raise privacy concerns, about which we will talk tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm show, 8 years ago, UPS placed an employee on unpaid leave when her pregnancy limited her ability to lift heavy objects. The Supreme Court hears her discrimination case, which could affect millions of American women.
Join the Diane Rehm show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about spirituality on campus, the rising nature of spirituality versus religiosity on campus. This is not only across the country, but here. And we, those of you following us on Twitter, we're interested in what religious spiritual offerings were available to you while you were in college. And you could be in college now. So this question is a contemporary one and also a question that looks back. And what would you like to have seen? Dr. Joanne Robinson's with us. She's the chair of an associate professor in the Department of Religious Studies at UNC Charlotte. Dr. Barbara Tita is also here from UNC Charlotte. She's a rabbi at Temple Or Olam. And Reverend Robert Spock is the chaplain at Davidson College. I want to point out that we did invite people from the Islamic tradition to be with us, but nobody returned our calls for whatever reason, so we're sorry for that. Let me get back to religious studies, because it's to teach about religions, not how to practice a religion, but to teach about and to broaden people's views of and get them to understand other religious views. How does that happen in the context of a college education? Are you strictly for majors, or do students come to you and pick and choose certain courses about religion that they want to learn about?
Oh, some of our students are certainly majors, and some are coming from completely different disciplines. I teach, among other things, Hebrew Bible, and that tends to pull students who've had the experience in Sunday school of learning a lot of Bible stories, so they think it'll be an easy course. It turns out to be a shocking realization that we aren't going to approach Bible the way that they learn to approach Bible. I have students who are Muslim, sometimes some Jewish students, many students who are just interested in sacred scripture, but the process of looking at that literature in an academic way is, in my experience, mind-blowing for my students. They really do have a different experience with that literature after that course is over.
But it also goes well beyond looking at scripture. And that's an important part of religious studies because those foundational texts are important. But we also teach courses like God and gangster rap,
right,
Bollywood and religion. I'll be teaching creationism in the spring with an anthropology professor. And so what we like to do is have students be able to look at things that they took for granted very often or thought were natural, and to look at them again and look at them critically. And so, religious studies is great for that.
Go ahead.
And I think that in addition to that, some students find their experience taking religious studies courses to be spiritually transformative. Mm. Students who take courses, for example, on Hinduism with Bill Mahoney at Davidson College, the way that he teaches Hinduism, the way he introduces them to the practices and to the thought, it transforms the students. The same thing with Hebrew Bible at times. I've known students who come into a Hebrew Bible class, they encounter the text in a new way. They've grown up in one tradition, but we've had a couple of students actually convert to Judaism in part because of their encounters with the texts beginning through academic courses. Or vice versa, students have encountered sort of Christian visions of the world through ethics courses that transform how they think about what it means to live out their faith.
Oh, and I would say the course I'm teaching this semester on anti-Semitism has been absolutely amazing in terms of the students coming out of that, learning what happens when an ideology becomes a cultural pathology and how does that affect them in the world where they are dealing with similar pathologies around race, for example.
Hmm.
If we go back to the spirituality issue, there was a book out a couple of years ago by Barbara Walvoord, and she studied introductory courses in religious studies and students' experiences in those. And what she discovered was this fascinating divide, which is that the faculty imagine what they're doing in those classes is teaching critical thinking. So whatever it is that they're teaching in religious studies, that's what they're after. Turns out that the students aren't after critical thinking at all. They're after spiritual growth.
That's what that was going to be my next question. Are they coming to you to learn about these various religions, or are they coming to you to satisfy the thirst they have in their personal lives for some sort of connection to spirituality?
Well, I think we definitely have a mix of people who are looking for different things. Sometimes they're taking a class because it fits their schedule. But often, however we design the course, so often we're dealing with such fundamental questions about meaning and values that students are going to make of it what they will for themselves. And that may not be part of the curriculum explicitly, but we know from studies that that's what students are making of it.
It's also the case that some students want to learn about their own tradition in a deeper way than they've ever had the opportunity before. So, for example, I know of Muslim students who come to Davidson and they have the opportunity to study Islam under a scholar of Islamic studies, and they're able to go deep in their tradition in a way that simply being in a Muslim family, it formed them incredibly important ways, being in a Muslim family. But the study of the tradition and the texts and the histories wasn't something that they were given, you know, in their family.
I have an email in my inbox exactly saying that from a Jewish student. I want to learn more about, you know, my heritage. Which of the courses that you're teaching in spring would be the best one for me to take?
And which would be? Which would be?
Oh, goodness. God and sex, maybe. No, probably for her, the Judaism course would probably be the best way for her to start out, because we do so much depth. We do a depth charge as best we can on what Judaism is and what it represents.
You have this kind of an ecumenical service at Davidson College, a worship opportunity. You call them worship opportunities, but it's all done with music. Is there a preacher up there of some sort, some kind of a person leading, a cleric of some sort leading this? Or
right. So
is it just music?
We have a wide variety of worship opportunities. I mean, we have traditional ones that you might think of, like we have Catholic Mass each week, we have an Episcopal Eucharist service each week. But the one in particular that draws the largest numbers is the Thursday night praise and worship service, and it's completely student-led. It started out with two students playing guitar in their residence hall room. A bunch of their friends started joining them. Then they couldn't fit in the room, so they moved into a lounge down the hall. Finally, there were so many people in the lounge after a few weeks, they had to move to the chapel of the Presbyterian Church on campus. And then after a couple of months, they couldn't fit in the chapel, so they had to ask permission to go into the sanctuary of the church. And now, and it's been 12 years since that was formed, and it's gotten passed down from generation to generation by the students, completely student-led. Huh. And now there's 250 to 300 students coming every week. And it's simply praise and worship music in the Christian tradition for about an hour and 15 minutes
and
every
Thursday
night.
These are not just Christians coming to this.
Right. So the vast majority of them are Christians, but students who are not Christians also attend. It's a space of tremendous peace because of the music that's being played. And it just creates an environment and an ethos that is, I think, very relaxing and very kind of comfortable for students, whether they're Christian or not.
Mm-hmm. When we talk about spirituality like that, where people are coming for the music and where people are seeking something, they don't know what, they don't want the rituals of organized religion, but they do want something that's missing. There's a little shadow throwback to the hippie days and having crystals out and incense. And was that part of that search? And is that still going on? Or has this morphed over time? Or is it all part of the same thing?
Well, arguably, the co-opting of the word spirituality into sort of pop culture use goes back to Shirley MacLaine and some other New Age movements in which people did try sort of alternative ways of looking at things. There was a big seeker movement, arguably, of people who were moving away from traditional religion but wanted something, particularly when they had young families. They would try to find a church that didn't have that old stuffy traditional feel about it. So the New Age reference and crystals and all isn't completely off the mark. I'm not sure that's what our students make of it, though.
Okay.
I think they would find that a little wacky.
Let me just say, I think that at least in the Jewish experience, my sense is that the students are coming for ritual, that they frequently do want to find ways to access again what it means to light Shabbat candles, what it means to say given prayers in ritual forms, what it is to live Jewishly. And so their search is about how to embed that in a way that will be real for them and not just rote, right? Not just because they were told to do it, but because it has intrinsic spiritual value to touch a mezuzah when they go out the door and to understand what is that going to mean for them on both a magical and a spiritual level, right? Mm-hmm. Because it has both. There is that sense you touch those words, then you will speak Torah. You know, in this place of connecting with ritual, I think they're very driven by that need.
Robert Spock.
I would agree that's the case. And I think at Davidson, at least, there are many, many students who, as I said before, are both spiritual and religious, and their religiosity is expressed in wanting to go to church and be part of a worshiping community that includes not just people their own age, but also people a variety of different ages. And so the church culture in our area is very vibrant, and a lot of students have chosen to be very, very involved, not just marginally involved, but very involved in those churches.
There is ritual in the Judaic, in the Jewish tradition. There is certainly ritual in the Catholic tradition, but there are Protestant religions where ritual really doesn't exist because they've de-emphasized all that on purpose to get away from Catholicism. Are the students who come from those traditions actually looking for that when they seek out spirituality, looking for something a little fancier, a little more meaningful, something that they can touch and take with them?
I don't know about fancier. But I do think they often are seeking mystery and not just things that are just very kind of clear cut and straightforward, but that there's a sense in which there is something beyond that matters deeply and that I want to be related to, but that I'm never going to fully grasp or understand. And that's a deep part of the whole Christian tradition, is understanding God not simply as this individual that you put in a box and completely get, but rather continually moving towards an understanding and towards a relationship with and towards an embodiment of the values that come from God's vision for the community and the world. And I think that mystery is something that students
That
see.
Search for mystery is very important. I mean, if I talk to Jewish students who came to Templar alums last service, because we're now just 4 minutes away from the university, so we're now seeing students showing up at our service, right? They love the music. They love the fact that we get up and we dance in the middle of services. We really do. Those kinds of things happen with us. And also there's this moment where if you're telling the story of why it is that in Jewish tradition there's a concept of getting an extra soul on the Sabbath. What does that extra soul mean? And you tell that story, or you tell the story of why it is that we look at our fingernails at Havdalah, Saturday night, when we separate between the holy Sabbath and the ordinary week, right? What are those fingernails representing, that translucent garment that Adam wore and Eve wore in the Garden of Eden, right? Then that attachment to the story, the narrative, the mythology, and the mystery is enormously powerful.
Dr. Robbins, I know you wanted to chime in on this for a while.
Well, when I think back to, I've been teaching at UNCC in the Religious Studies Department for 17 years, and although some of my colleagues now think it's sort of legendary when I say it, that I used to have Bible-thumping students in class who had no tolerance of ambiguity or mystery. For them, there was an answer. It could be found in that book. If I were to say something about the history of Christianity that was not in the book, they would challenge me as not part of Christianity. That was part of my job for a while, and either I've gotten better at teaching or the students themselves have changed. And I find in general, they are far more interested in tolerating ambiguity and being more open to other people's ideas. Again, that's anecdotal. It's from my experience in the classroom, but it certainly seems to have been a wave. And I think it may be connected to this idea of spirituality as sort of an ability to deal with ambiguity and embrace it.
Mm. Right. And I think along with that is this movement that's growing in the country of interfaith relation between students who value their particular tradition and want to interact with students of other traditions. And it's not throwing out their particularity, but it's saying in order to live in this really pluralistic world, part of what we want and need to do is to understand and communicate with each other well across faith traditions or across religious traditions. And so at Davidson, it's been fascinating to see that growth of interfaith conversation led by a variety of different students from different traditions. Muslim students, Jewish students, Catholic students, Protestant students, atheist students have all been invested in these interfaith conversations. And it's been a remarkable experience for me to be part of it.
Dr. Robinson, earlier in this conversation, you mentioned that the freshmen are sometimes reluctant to be to talk about on these surveys of being spiritual. And the UCLA study does point that out. It shows that spirituality is more important to the juniors in college than it is to the freshmen. The juniors are more involved, they say, in a spiritual quest than the younger group, but that spiritual people tend to be religious, and religious people tend to be spiritual. Mm-hmm. Is this some sort of a sliding scale?
Absolutely. And I think so often, particularly in this sort of study, it's up to the person who is reading the thing to define it as they will. So I'm looking at the same study you are. And one of the things that they do is look at indicators of student spirituality. And they ask students to rate themselves on a scale on, for instance, quote, have an interest in spirituality. That doesn't give us much more information than spirituality. It doesn't tell us how we're defining that, and so it leaves it for the student to do so. And I think that's a bit problematic.
If there is this increase in spirituality on college campuses and this desire to quench that thirst, even though religious attendance at mainline churches has been on the decline, particularly among younger people, is that reason for hope for these mainline churches that the pendulum will swing back the other way once they've explored the spiritual side of things and now they want the ritual, now they want the things that an individual denomination will bring them in the future?
You know, I think, and we face this issue in the Jewish world too, which is declining membership in Jewish congregational settings. And this is also anecdotal on my part to some extent, but I do think that the present generation needs to have venues that welcome them in ways that are really more creative than synagogue life has been able to achieve over the decades. And so I think it is on those mainline institutions, my own included, to be able to think very, very deeply about the way these students want to reattach. So, for example, when I tell people, yes, my people will get up and dance at a service, there will be an awful lot of people in the Jewish community who will say, well, you've got to be joking. No, seriously. And I'll say, no, actually, Reb Zusha had his arms up and danced through his services too. This is a tradition, right? So bringing a way for those students to experience, those young people to experience spontaneity in religious expression, I think may be one of our most important challenges. Now I'm speaking as the rabbi, not the teacher.
And the assumption here, I think, in your question is that the mainline traditions have a stake in this somehow because they own something about what people want. And there's something to be said about that. But I think, you know, you can also look at people who are not explicitly religious, who do all of those things and have those connections and have those experiences outside traditional mainstream religious institutions, to use a bunch of very heavy words.
We're talking to three people who are involved academically and religiously or spiritually at the college level with the UNC Charlotte and Davidson College. And when we come back, I want to turn the question around because there's a rising tide of nuns out there, N-O-N-E-S. We'll come back in just a second. Stay with us. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and historic South End Gallery Crawl, featuring six galleries within walking distance of Food Truck Friday, this Friday, 4 till 7 p.m. Details at historicsouthend.com. And from PNC Wealth Management, with over 160 years of experience and a team of financial professionals committed to helping clients achieve financial goals. More from Jennifer Green at 704-686-2121. 29. In 2006, United Parcel Service placed an employee on unpaid leave when her pregnancy limited her ability to lift heavy objects. Well, now the Supreme Court is hearing her discrimination case, which could affect millions of American women. And that will be the topic of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, charlottetalks@wfae.org will get you to us, as will searching for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter, and we're coming right back.
When there's a big breaking story, there can be a rush to connect the dots. Doing that too quickly, though, risks coming up with the wrong picture. At Morning Edition, we take the time to get the facts and create a true picture, the whole story. Listen each weekday as we collect the dots. Let's find out what they mean together on Morning Edition.
You can hear Morning Edition from 5 until 9 here on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Reverend Robert Spock, the chaplain at Davidson College, Dr. Barbara Tita, who's a rabbi at Temple Or Olam and a senior lecturer at the Department of Religious Studies at UNC Charlotte, and Dr. Joanne Robinson, who's the chair of that department at UNC Charlotte, about the rising nature of spirituality on college campuses. A recent UCLA study pointed that out, that even though religion is declining or attendance at religious services among mainline traditional organizations is declining, spirituality among college students is on the rise, and evidently it's on the rise at least at these two college campuses around Charlotte. We did invite people from the Islamic tradition to join us. They never got back to us, and we apologize for that. We have done a program on the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, those who believe, I guess, in none of the above. Some would characterize themselves as being atheists. Some would be agnostic. But they don't belong to an organized religion of any kind and don't think about it. Can the birth of that trend be traced to you guys? Because
we did it. We admit it.
Because when kids go to college, no matter what kind of a life they come from before they go to college, the whole purpose of college is to explore the world and to see what's out there and to broaden your worldview. And this is what it could lead to, right?
Well, okay. So there are many conservative pundits through the years who have argued that, for instance, college is a hotbed of apostasy. Send your children to college and they will lose their faith. Mm-hmm. It actually turns out that students who do not go to college lose their faith at higher rates.
Really?
Absolutely.
How do you explain that?
I explain that in part because can I explain that? Can you explain that?
At the college level, right, eventually they are searching for the meaning of their existence. They are asking questions about who they are.
But then I think Mike's question is, why is it that those who don't go to college do then drop their religious affiliation? Yeah. One would think that they would just stay with the traditional mode that they're comfortable with.
I think there is an issue there, that in a college environment, when you're being challenged to think about this issue over and over and over again, that may be one of the reasons that spirituality or religion is at least part of the question that you're asking yourself, and that maybe in that external world, just stopping going to church, stopping going to synagogue and, you know, working your way through the day and having your children, your family, you know, it might be a reason that those younger people are falling off when they're not in college, constantly being asked to address these very questions in their liberal arts classes, ethics, morals.
You want to chime in on this, Reverend?
You know, I really don't feel like I can speak to why the people that don't go to college, unless it has something to do with the broader culture as well, which may not portray religious faith in ways that actually reflect the depth and reality that that faith and tradition and belief and practice can have for people. And so if you're not exposed, which I think you can get exposed to that as part of your college experience, that you might not if you just don't have any.
And I really want to question that issue of nuns. Like the last time I was on this program, we were talking about the Pew Report, among other things, which declared this, you know, horrible disaster for all Judaism, right? We were going to see the rising of the nuns, Jewish people who weren't attached to Judaism, Jewish rituals, and all the rest. And one of the things I mentioned to you is, look, if you take a look at that report, which had its flaws, but one of the questions was, you know, how many people believed that Israel was granted to the Jewish people by God? And almost 20% of the people who declared themselves to be nuns, people of no religion, said that God had given Israel to the Jewish people. Wait, hold on. right? So people's responses are frequently much more complicated when they label themselves as nuns. What does that really mean?
Well, we have I think on that program we did talk about there is in fact a rising group, a growing number of people who identify as nuns, even if they don't know the term.
But what does that mean?
And what does it mean? Yeah. Some are agnostic, some are atheists, some simply don't go to church, but maybe have a faith base. Somebody are back in the deep, dark recesses of their mind. Mm. But among those nuns and among the rising number of atheists who are coming out of the closet, so to speak, because it seems safer to be able to say I don't believe in God today than it did in 1950, they may be listening to this and thinking, why are you even having this discussion? Why is this important? Who cares if you're seeking spirituality? Why is it important?
I'll speak from the point of view of the Secular Student Alliance on campus. I'm the faculty advisor for that group, and this is a group of students who—
Wait a minute. They've taken the chairman of the Religious Studies Department and put her in charge of the Secular Alliance?
You presume. They didn't. The students put me in charge of it, yes, and I was more than happy to do so. I teach a course on atheism, so the tradition of disbelief or skepticism or free thinking, depending on how you want to frame it. Mm-hmm. And there, depending on the semester, we have 35 to 50 students who are committed in some cases to still trying to figure out. They're not committed atheists necessarily. They're sometimes agnostic. Sometimes they're very, very angry, like the four horsemen of the atheist apocalypse. They just want to banish all religion. In general, though, they tend to want to think about this stuff. From their point of view, the reason that you should have a program like this is that when you walk across campus, Christian groups are advertising things all the time on the sidewalks, on the bulletin boards. It is absolutely everywhere. And they would like to have a voice.
Well, Dr. Tita, you have said that despite the growing diversity on campus, many of the Christian groups on campus are evangelical in nature, which can pose issues for secular or non-Christians at UNC Charlotte.
For Christians, I want to say.
Okay. How so?
There are some Christian students I have who find the evangelical nature of those groups challenging because they want to do the kind of work that is involved in interfaith understanding, and that involves putting the evangelical stuff outside the room. The group that I was faculty advisor for a while, the Interfaith Alliance, made a commitment, no evangelical speech inside that community so that people could speak about who they were, what they represented, agnostics and atheists among them,
but
freely
no evangelical
and safely.
Agnostics.
Yes, that also. No.
Say that again?
No evangelical agnostics.
Right. No evangelical speech of any kind. That is a challenge. That is a particularly deep challenge for Jews and, in the context of being told that you're damned or you're condemned in some way or to have to face that kind of message. It's a message we've heard for over 2,000 years, and it has led to some very dangerous and scary things. That's why I teach a course on it.
Okay.
So that particular kind of speech is challenging. Yes.
At Davidson, I think part of what our student group called Better Together, which is the interfaith group on campus, has sought to do is not to exclude students who are evangelical from the group, to welcome them and to also welcome atheist students and agnostic students as part of the conversation. The reality is that the world we live in is not a Christian world. It's not a secular world. Mm-hmm. It's a world where there is an incredible pluralism of worldviews, and it makes for a better education for people to be able to interact with others who have a variety of worldviews during these college years and know them as human beings. And then when they go out into the broader world, it won't just be stereotypical evangelicals or stereotypical Muslims. It'll be my friend John or my friend, Ikra or whoever, right? And so part of what this is helped by the fact that we're a small campus. These students are interacting with each other in the choir. They're interacting with each other on the sports field. And so they come together in these other contexts where they can then share from their perspectives, including the evangelical students.
Well, should this be required? I mean, there are so many requirements in college. You have to take math. You have to take English. Should religious studies of some sort, some overview, religious studies 101, be required? Because it seems to me that we can't get along. We have these tremendous tensions between Jews and Muslims, and between Muslims and Christians, and between Muslims who want to be very, very, very conservative, such as ISIS, mm-hmm. which I think is more political than it is Islamic, certainly. If we knew more about each other, would we begin to see the similarities and have less friction among us?
There's so much in that question, but I want to thank you for asking it because I hope the provost and chancellor are listening, because I would argue that, yes, religious studies should be required of all students, precisely for the reasons that you say. It shows students the complexities of people's worldviews. It helps them understand other people, as opposed to some kind of cartoonish representation, some kind of stereotype. That said, at Harvard, for instance, there was a push to start a course required for all students called Reason and Faith. And the idea in that course was to have all students have to wrestle with these ideas about what counts for evidence, what is authority, all that kind of good stuff that you can get into in the humanities. And it was shot down because there are so many hot button issues having to do with religious studies. And there's so much misunderstanding about what we do that it would be a hard thing politically.
Give me a couple of hot button issues.
Well, let's see. I'm teaching creationism in the spring, and we'll have 80, maybe 150, it depends, students in that classroom. There will be students in there who are creationists. Mm-hmm. There will be students in there who are diehard believers, so to speak, I hate to use that word, in evolution. The students will argue amongst themselves.
Gee, what a horrible thing.
There are some who would say that actually is a horrible thing because for them, the scientific answer is the answer.
Okay.
And there should not be a discussion about
creationism. Isn't that the whole point of college, to explore ideas that are new and different and not necessarily those that you hold?
From my point of view, absolutely. But there certainly are people who would say, and this has happened in various places, that religious studies doesn't belong on a college campus because religion is something set apart. That is the assumption that it's something
that
you do in your, quote, personal life.
Isn't that the problem?
That's exactly the problem. Thank you. That's right. That is the problem.
Okay. I'll become the provost.
Thank you.
Alex on Facebook asks what – and we've kind of covered this, but he has a different take on it. What is spirituality? I meditate semi-regularly, yet have no belief in spirituality. Man-made practices seem futile. I believe in mind and body as one because that's all I have. Any comment on that? You don't have to comment. I'm just asking. Okay. Larry emails, my thoughts on religion are reduced to these two. One, nothing can be more helpful to people experiencing joy or pain. Two, nothing has caused more war and killing and pain and is causing it now. How do you reconcile those two things?
I reconcile them all the time. Actually, that's not true. I put them before students all the time in the classroom and recognize that there's no reconciliation between the two, but that those things are always in tension.
Gus asks, during your conversation, you used the word magic. I think you've used magic,
mm-hmm.
Dr. Tita, or magical. Did you mean to use that word, or did you mean to use the word mystery? If not, please explain your use of the word magic as it applies to Judaism.
Oh, that's a wonderful question and comes at such a timely point, because one of the things I'm doing is working on an article about Havdalah, which is that ritual of separation. Havdalah was understood by Jewish writers to be the perfect point to perform magic. That was the time in the Jewish liturgical year to do that. I use that intentionally because our tradition and our history has been filled with all sorts of magical practices that include, among other things, a kind of overlay with mystical practices. So it would take me an entire show to do that, and I'm looking at the clock, but the person who wrote in, feel free to write to me at my university address, and I'll give a longer and much more detailed answer.
Which is incredibly difficult. What is your university address? It's incredibly difficult.
B, as in Barbara, Tita, T-H-I-E, D as in Don, another E. You'll find me if you Google rabbi at Temple or Olam, that'll be another way, at uncc.edu.
Okay. Does this kind of exposure to diversity of religious belief at both of your schools and around the country, does it – and this desire to explore spirituality, does it impact ultimately a person's political point of view, secularly?
Well, arguably these polls when they do their figuring in of the data, they think that this might be very good information for Democrats in the future, because it seems to argue that those students who consider themselves spiritual and not religious, mm-hmm. or spiritually religious, tend to lean left or liberal in their political views on the whole.
You want to chime in on that?
You know, I think students are unpredictable in my experience. Uh-huh. And students who have a deep faith, students who have a deep practice of their religion, I've seen them be very politically conservative or politically liberal. I've also seen students who move between different positions on different issues, and that their faith motivates them in a variety of different ways that you can't always predict how it's going to make someone sort of vote.
And I'd like to kind of bring us back to something you said earlier, which, you know, was the discovery that, you know, the world isn't Christian, the world isn't this, the world isn't that, right? Now, that is an effort that all three of us are engaged in demonstrating. But I think that part of the equation is for students to realize that, yes, in America and in most of Europe, the world is a Christian world,
yeah.
and that the discourse of that world is just as in the name of the program, right? You know, the state of faith, that so many subtle ways are drifting around them that help determine the nature of the discourse around spirituality and around religion. And they must study that. They must acknowledge that. They must understand that. They must know why, for a Jewish or a Muslim student, the world will look profoundly different, even in this country, than it will for a Christian student. Those things are salient and critical and important critiques that they must have.
If there's this difference between the Christian viewpoint and the Jewish and Muslim viewpoint, is there an equal difference between the Jewish and the Muslim viewpoint?
So first, I want to very quickly say that naming any of these as Christian, Jewish, Muslim is problematic. There's a huge bandwidth in each one.
I was absolutely agreeing with you that to answer that question quickly is
impossible.
It's not possible, right?
Okay, yeah.
We'll save it for another show.
Exactly. That's Dr. Barbara Tita, Rabbi at Temple Or Olam, Senior Lecturer in the Department of Religious Studies at UNC Charlotte. Dr. Joanne Robinson, Chair and Associate Professor of Religious Studies in that department at UNC Charlotte. And Reverend Robert Spock, the Chaplain at Davidson College. Thank you all for the hour.
Thank you so very much.
Really appreciate it.